And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast Live from a very high floor of a hotel in San Francisco, California, where somehow, after a game that was surreal, sad, thrilling, and an experience the likes of which you and I will never have, we are here and it is time to say the three most exciting words in niche basketball podcasting. What up, Beck?
What up? Also in niche basketball podcasting, as we've established.
I got some corrections on that.
We should never attempt it again.
So here we are. We're going to game six. We'll talk about game six later because in true NBA fashion, the finals is about the third most important thing going on in the NBA, even though this is the series which decides the NBA champion, which is the whole point of this, this extravaganza, this league and everything like that. Where 48 hours have passed, almost. I've forgotten where we are.
I don't know what day it is. I don't know what time it is. I don't know what time zone we're in. I do know you have a spectacular view of this high floor.
Well, Howard, you don't host the Low Post podcast and get an eighth floor room, okay, pal? You get 26th for hosting the niche basketball podcast. I have reached a stage where I'm trying to open my hotel room with keys from other hotels.
Oh, I have keys from other hotels just sitting in my backpack. Cause then it's like, I end up finding, like, you get to the airport and you're like, oh, I still have this hotel. I don't want to just like throw it away. I'm going to be at another 17,000 different Marriotts. I'll just return it. But then it just stays in my bag and I forget. So I just have a nice collection.
So here's a confession. It did not register to me that Raptors fans were cheering when Kevin Durant was injured.
Yes. I'm glad you brought this up because I was getting killed on Twitter.
So here's why. Here's what happened a minute before Kevin Durant got injured. I looked at the video box score next to me on press row.
Yeah.
And I turned to Timmy Goodtimes Bontemps, who was sitting next to me. And I said, man, KD's already played 11 minutes. Like, does that strike you as weird? That's a lot of minutes. Like, he's only been 13 minutes in the game. He's already played 11. It's kind of not what I expected.
Yeah.
And then he goes to drive on Serge Ibaka. The image is going to be seared into my head forever. I know exactly, like, I can picture the angle I was sitting at. It was diagonally to my left. Kevin Durant falls to the ground. The gasp across press row is audible.
Same with ours.
I stand up and lean forward to get a better view of what happened. And for about 2 minutes, nothing else is registering to me other than what's going on with Kevin Durant. Is he walking? No, he's not walking. What's Steve Kerr's expression? What's Rick Celebrini, the doctor's expression? What's happening? Who's helped? So the fact that Raptors fans were cheering, I just blacked out everything except the image of maybe the best player in the NBA, someone who is on pace to be one of the 10 greatest players ever at worst, has just crumpled to a heap in a game that was all about should he come back. And now the answer, the question has been answered for us in the worst possible way. So I just didn't even register it.
I'm glad you brought this up, because I had the same basic experience you did. I know where you were sitting. You were a couple sections down from where I was. I was more like end zone.
Section 116 in Air Canada Center. That's my home.
I was 114, and so mine was more of a straight on view down the court from the end zone. And same thing. So he goes down, audible gasps across our section of press row, and I'm like hand over my mouth, literally like going, oh no, oh no, this just can't be the, like, and I, for a minute I thought, as other people did, like, didn't Serge Ibaka say something like, I thought he lost his shoe or whatever. He goes down where we're sitting. Like, people need to understand this at home. You're watching on your TV and you've got the close up views immediately. You've got angles. You've got whatever.
I didn't see the rippling close up of his leg until 2 hours after the game.
No, I saw somebody tweeted into my timeline at some point and then I saw it and then I thought, is this even real? But the guy waving and all that. Like, we don't see that where we're sitting. We're in the bowl and there's people screaming around us and there's people sitting in front. And so it's mayhem. You're in the arena. So we are not experiencing the game the same way that TV watchers at home watching on your 100-inch flat screen. So just as you're seeing a better view sometimes than the refs can see of certain plays, they're not seeing what you're seeing. We're not seeing what you're seeing either, people. So to that point, I didn't realize it either. I'm taking notes. I'm trying to keep track of all the same things you are. And then when he finally gets up and is being walked off the court, he's got, you know, the one arm around Celebrini, and I think at that point he's got the other arm around Iguodala, and I saw him look up into the stands our direction, like he's looking up toward the section I'm sitting in, and I thought it was a really curious thing that he made this one glance up into the stands, I think, just to kind of take it in as he's walking off. And as he did that, that's when I started hearing the KD chants. So I tweet, really nice moment as Durant gets KD chants as he's walking into the tunnel. I get this flurry of swipes tweeting back at me.
Well, you're on fire. That's two curses already. My editor said, can you please tell Howard not to curse so we can edit this podcast more quickly?
I'm sorry. That'll be my last one.
Well, I don't
These
care.
Jerkwads are killing me, like going, why are you being an apologist for Toronto? And you're covering it up. They were just cheering his injury a minute ago. And all of a sudden, I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about. And it's not until post game when people are being asked about it. And then people noted that, you know, Lowry had motioned for people to stop and all this.
I didn't see that.
Again, I saw none of this. Where we're sitting, you don't see it. We're not watching the TV screen. So our consumption of the game, the way we're taking it in, is just fundamentally different. And so I'm glad people on Twitter let me know this. I wish they'd let me know it a little kinder way and not as part of some grand.
That's a good one.
Once again, Zach, I am guilty of doing the dumbest thing in the world, which is looking at my mentions. But we just didn't know. We're seeing the game differently, inside sometimes than you're seeing it on TV. And we're far enough away that little details, like somebody like motioning for the crowd to stop or whatever, if I'm not looking where Kyle Lowry is and I'm just focused purely on seeing is he getting up, or maybe I'm scrambling to try to switch the stats monitor to the video feed so I can get the replays. We just didn't see it. So anyway.
So this is not even an interesting issue to me.
Yeah.
Because if you are a fan cheering for a player getting injured, bad look, not a great
right,
look.
Gross.
Not, I'm not going to call you a bad person because you've had a momentary slip up in your life that doesn't make you bad. Just, there's no like, let's grapple with the complexity of the reaction and all Toronto might win the championship so the fans are excited and they don't know what to do. No, it's bad. It's a bad look. You shouldn't do it. It's not an interesting.
Also, by the way, there was a breakaway. And so they could have been cheering the breakaway. Like, even in the moment, like, as I tried to process, like, well, maybe they were cheering something else. It's not until I saw replays later that I saw, like, oh, okay, there were some people, probably not all. That's the other thing we do. The crowd cheered the injury. The crowd chanted KD. And we all do this. There's 20,000 people in the building. It only takes, like, a couple hundred doing any one thing for us to then say the crowd. It might have been different portions of the crowd who cheered versus those who chanted KD. Anyway,
whatever. Forget it. People, it's that time of year again, basketball's home stretch. This is where all the hard work pays off when we see who's tough enough to be crowned the champion of the NBA. It's where players are more driven than ever to go further, faster, and longer. And that's what drives Goodyear to make tires that do the very same thing. Goodyear knows that performance is everything, whether it's on the road or on the basketball court. So when it comes to choosing tires, let Goodyear.com help you choose what's best. Goodyear, more driven.
This was all leading up to me asking, 48 hours have passed, where are you on the whole what happened? Is there, what do we know? What did Kevin know? What were the risks? How can we possibly begin to address this now that there's been some time?
I don't think we can intelligently analyze a lot of this. In terms of, like, what did he know? Did he know the risks? Did the Warriors do all the right things? Those questions we may not have answers to for quite a while, if ever. And I pointed this out, and I did a podcast a little bit ago with Sam Amick from The Athletic on my podcast, and I said this to Sam that, you know, there's medical privacy issues. So we are not entitled to anything. Kevin Durant is entitled to whatever he can get from the Warriors if he doesn't already know everything he needs to know. Maybe the players' union has a role to play here about protocols and return to play procedures with regard to calf strains or lower extremity injuries. I don't know. You and I have no rights to anything. We'll get what we can get over the coming weeks and months. We might not know the answers, but I think what it comes down to is this. There's some procedure. There is some set of protocols. And Rick Celebrini, the Warriors director of player care, and keep screwing up his title, but it's that general vicinity, is really highly regarded. And other doctors were consulted and other people. I have no doubt in my mind, knowing the Warriors as we do, that they were thorough. And you can make all the right decisions and still have the wrong outcome. And I don't know that that's the case. I'm not trying to say that they did everything right. I'm not trying to excuse anything or anybody. I'm saying we don't know, and I'm saying that I do think the Warriors deserve the benefit of the doubt, and I also think that if the decision ultimately rests with the player, which I'm guessing it did.
Well, we've already seen that if the medical team deems a risk over X percent, the decision does not rest with the player.
Yes.
They force Klay Thompson not to play game three.
Agreed. Because of the nature of this one and because of the potential risks involved, my assumption is, and I should have clarified or classified it that way, that my assumption would be that they said, listen, here's what we know. Here's what the risks might be. And then he makes the decision at that point. Is an organization obligated, is a team obligated to protect a player from himself? Do they, you know, there is some of that, and they clearly acted in that regard with Klay.
I think so. Look, I mean, obviously, if their risk assessment had been, whatever, every player has some chance of tearing an Achilles.
Right, there's always a risk.
Let's say that's, given the rate of Achilles tears, it's incredibly low. It's much less than 1% or much less than half of a tenth of 1% or something. If they had any idea that there was a 5, 10, 12, 15% chance of tearing an Achilles, obviously you do not let him play. Those numbers are way too big. I mean, if someone told you you had a 10% chance of getting struck by lightning today, you would not go outside. You would be like 10 out of 100. That's like a lot of times. It's incredibly difficult, obviously, for us to recreate exactly how this process works.
Exactly.
What is the percent chance? What are you actually trying to measure could happen that percentage of time? Are you doing that for all sorts of injuries? An aggravation? I don't know. And what makes this very hard. So I, like Tom Habershaw, wrote a great piece about this for NBC. He talked to a bunch of sports scientists in the wake of this, and they were questioning 12 of the first 14 minutes. Seems like a bad idea. Now, I said that to Tim Bontemps before. I just said this is kind of not what I expected.
Sure.
I did not expect this. I didn't expect them to be running the same pin down sets for him that they normally run. I didn't expect him to bring the ball up. I didn't expect any of that.
Yeah, I think we all expected him to stand in the corner and stretch the defense and make a shot here and there.
So all of these sports scientists tell Tom, you know, that's probably a mistake. You know, probably, you know, one of them said inexcusable, I think, in the story. I've had sports scientists tell me some of the following things. So Steve Kerr tells Rachel Nichols after the game, and I saw them walking out together, that, you know, they told us that the doctors told us it couldn't get worse, right? The injury couldn't get worse. Obviously that was not the case. I've had a bunch of sports scientists tell me, there's just no way that there must be a communication breakdown between the doctors to Steve. By the way, Steve walking out of the arena, can you imagine his brain trying to give an articulate statement at that
point? Shell-shocked.
Everybody's shell-shocked. Given what has happened, given the game, given we're going back to Toronto or we're going back to Golden State, all of this stuff. Like, I if there were a communication breakdown, I would understand it. But all the sports scientists told me there is just no way that a team of medical specialists that included, according to the Warriors, Kevin Durant's own hand-picked, separate from the team, medical specialist would have been able to say with anything like certainty, it can't get worse. It can always get worse. A re-injury could be a worse re-injury. So I just think that was worded not correctly. There's curiosity of. There's been curiosity since it happened of the initial calf injury. Like, was it a calf injury? Where on the calf was it? I've been told that where the strain, and sometimes a strain is a partial tear, right? Where was that? Was it close to the Achilles? Was it far from the Achilles? Maybe that matters. I've heard how much activity he was able to do before the game really matters. And the less you do, the more risky it is because the ramp up has been so accelerated. And I've heard lots of them tell me, of course an Achilles injury is linked to what came before because all of those things are on what Jeff Stotts, an injury expert in his own writing, called the same kinetic chain. That's a lot of second guessing. And what I will say, what makes this so difficult to analyze is that all of the analysis is informed by what happened. So what happened And thus the conclusion is there must have been a mistake. They must have gotten it wrong. And I guess that is one way to look at it, because this is a horrible outcome. It's the worst possible outcome. Because you can actually almost say, because this happened, he shouldn't have played. I can see that. I can get there. I sympathize with that. But we're all analyzing from the result back. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, exactly. It's a human reaction that if you see, as you say, the worst happen, therefore some mistake must have been made to allow that to happen. And I can't dismiss that outright, right? Like everybody has said, Steve Kerr said it again to us today. Obviously, knowing what we know, we wouldn't have let him go back out there. So then it's, well, why didn't you know this? Why with all the diagnostics, all the study, all of the drills, all of the assessments,
that's
all of the opinions?
That's why I can only conclude that they're telling the truth when they say we saw no risk of an Achilles injury. Because if it's 5%, 10%, whatever, that's too much. This right. is the worst injury you can suffer.
This is what I think people should be certain of. If they knew there was that 5%, 10%,
you're out.
3%.
You don't play.
Right. They would not have sent him back out there. I believe that. I do not believe. Now, we have, I know, decades of history of sports teams acting cynically, acting in their own interests and not of those of players, especially in football. There's some famous cases in baseball. I don't know off the top of my head of any in the NBA where this became something that was scandalous or a lawsuit or a grievance by a player saying, no, they put my health at risk. I don't think we're about to see the first one. I don't think that's what this was. I trust that the Warriors did all their due diligence and this still happened. And by the way, that's the world we live in. It can happen. And we're only speculating. We don't have medical degrees and we don't know what they did. But I am certain, knowing the Warriors as we do, knowing who Steve Kerr is and what he's about, what Bob Myers is about, I dismiss outright any suggestion that this was because they pushed him out there because they just were thinking of the Warriors' interest instead of his. I think they went through everything that they could, and we still got a bad outcome.
No, and the interesting, you cannot separate the context of the game from the decision. So there was a certain risk level, clearly, and one they were aware of. Okay, obviously there was a bigger risk level than they were aware of, but clearly there was a risk level because he would not have played if it was a regular season. He would not, I bet he wouldn't have played if they were up 3-1. So there was a risk reward level. That's my speculation.
Wasn't there also a sense that he was, that game five is what they'd always been targeting? There'd been some reporting around that, I think. I think Sam has reported
target.
That.
It yeah. seemed to be there was 3, 4, 5. Well, like, so clearly if he wouldn't have played in a regular season game, you are acknowledging that there is some risk. And the reward of coming back to win the finals from 3-1 down factors into that equation as well. You can't separate it from the fact that he's going to be a free agent and his long-term place on the Warriors is
Agreed.
In question. Now, an interesting subplot of that is A, he has a player option. B, the Warriors can and likely, well, before this, were absolutely going to offer him a 5-year max contract. They still can. C, he has spent this entire year watching the Warriors rehabilitate DeMarcus Cousins from an Achilles tear. And so he's had a firsthand look at how they do that. And he's had DeMarcus Cousins to look at and talk to all year. So, you know, his decision in free agency will not be a complete referendum on all of those things, but it will be an interesting factor into it, right? Like if he still trusts this medical staff after what happened, and I don't have any evidence to say otherwise, and he likes the way they've rehabbed DeMarcus, like that could maybe be a factor in what he decides to do, because he's going to have options. Some of these teams that were going to offer him the max will still offer him the max.
I think it was always going to be the case that there was going to be some emotional component, even before this injury, some emotional component to the decision of whether to stay with the Warriors or sign elsewhere, right? Like there was always going to be this sense of, you know, does winning another championship with them, does it bind you to them even more? Does them winning without you have some implications for how you process your decision and whether you want to be back part of it? Like all these things. And now going out the way he did, injuring himself, you can draw a conclusion in either direction. If there were resentment, feeling like, you know what, you misled me or you allowed me to go out and you shouldn't have, then that works against them, clearly. if you felt like they did everything possible and you trusted them and it's just bad luck, and you otherwise think that this is a team that really has taken good care of you, or it's taken good care of DeMarcus Cousins and his rehab or whatever, or just you want the security of knowing, you don't need the security. Someone's going to give you the money. But if you just felt like I'm going to rehab it on their dime and, you know, prolong my free agency, for another year because now I want to see how I feel then and how I'm playing then. I mean, I don't know. I just think that the human element, the emotional element, aside from the basketball, the contractual, the legacy, the where do I want to, you know, spend the next 4 or 5 years of my career, I think there's an emotional element that comes into play here because going out the way he did the other night, it just casts everything in a different light.
And it's just, it's incredibly sad, obviously. And the whole finals has been unlike any series ever. And it's to the point where...
Ever.
I'm not as excited to see what the outcome is anymore. I'm not, it just hasn't been a normal finals. I mean, you can go right through it. Game one, Toronto wins relatively easily. Game two, exciting Warriors. That felt like a final game. Exciting third quarter. Here they go. Iguodala makes the shot at the end, blah, blah, blah. Game three, no Clay, fake game, not a competitive game, stupid owner does stupid thing. Feels like a month ago.
I'd already forgotten about stupid owner doing
game
stupid thing.
Game four feels like the knockout blow.
The end, yeah.
And then game five, KD, and then, by the way, a classic game unfolds after that. It just hasn't felt normal. But let's talk about the series before we get to Anthony Davis, because now we might as well transition more smoothly. It's 3-2 Toronto. On some level, everyone wanted to rush to make they were getting the trophy ready. They were lining the locker rooms with champagne. This is how close they were. I get that. They were close. It felt in the building like the Kawhi run was the last straw and the series was going to be over. That's what it felt like. But 6 points in 3 minutes is nothing. This is not like the Spurs in 2013. Being 28 seconds up by five or whatever. It's not even close to that. My wife texted me. She's going to be so mad. She doesn't listen to my podcast, so someone's going to have to alert her that this happened.
She's already called you out on Twitter a couple times in the series.
She's being very mean to me. She texted me a bunch of exclamation points when the Raptors went up by six, because she just wants me to come home. Yeah. Like, Ardar's being a pain. Come home. Just help. And I texted her back, there's a lot of time left, and these are the Warriors. Like, 6 points for them is, they can go on a 20-0 run in 3 minutes. I mean, like, it's not even that crazy. And then she said, you're being Debbie Downer, like you always are.
She's not
literally
wrong.
As that text was coming in, Klay Thompson hit a three. I'm like, this is why you don't text all the exclamation points. So, the Raptors were close, they could smell it, but that, I don't think that, it was a gut punch loss, but, I don't think it's like one of those things that's going to wobble their team. Like, we got that close and it was taken away from us. Okay, so it's 3-2. Toronto is plus 30 for the series overall. It feels like the terms of engagement are now set. There is no Kevin Durant thing hovering over the series. He's not going to play. It feels like Toronto has established itself under those terms of engagement as the better team and that they should win. And if you put a gun to my head right now, I would pick them to win tomorrow. I think they can win on the road. The road team has won the last four games. But then let's do a thought exercise. Throw out game three, which is the game Clay didn't play. The margin now drops to Toronto plus 16 in four games, which is still significant, but it's 2-2. It's 2-2 in real games. Cause that Clay game was not a real game. In real games, it's 2-2. Doesn't it still feel like it's Toronto's series to lose? For sure, right?
Yes, for sure. Both of the Warriors' wins have been by, like, a hair.
Sure. The Warriors' wins have been more high wire X than the Raptors' wins, and even excluding the Clay game.
And we don't know this for sure because, I'm not a physics professor, but if not for Draymond's, like, fingernail on Kyle Lowry's shot with the super slow-mo, super zoomed angles that showed that he got something on that ball, does that shot go in? If it does, we're not having this conversation. We're not sitting here with this gorgeous view of San Francisco. It's already over. And it was that, it's that close. And so I think Toronto has this thing, in its grasp, and they certainly could close this out tomorrow, but there's just something, I feel like we're going back. I feel like we're going back because.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even think it's a hot take.
No, it's not a hot take. I said wow because it would be incredibly exciting. As much as there's part of me that wants to go have Father's Day at home for many reasons, that building and the Warriors being on the verge of overcoming a 3-1 deficit.
So here's the thing. The Raptors have been and are the better team. You can say asterisk Kevin Durant, fine. But they've been the better team. They are the better team right now. And they've got better depth. And the Warriors need absolutely everything to go right to win any of these games and to win again tomorrow. But we now have Klay presumably, seemingly, back fully healthy.
He looks fine.
Which they did not have a fully healthy Klay. Obviously, they didn't have Klay at all for game 3. And by game 4, Steph is gassed from game 3. So this will be the first game where we've got both of them presumably at 100% and the certainty that there is no KD. And granted, the 12 minutes KD did play the other night were very, very important minutes.
And yeah, that's what I should acknowledge in saying it's 2-2 in real games is like one of the games was a KD for a little bit game and right. That helped.
Yes, it did. So without him, can they manufacture the same kind of game and effort? I mean, for one night at Oracle with everybody charged up for the last night ever of them playing there and with the Warriors still fighting for their lives and they themselves, like look at the way they got off the court. Now it was tempered by all the sorrow over KD, but in the moment that the buzzer hit, they're bouncing, they're hopping, Steph's smiling, and they're, I think they've gotten Drake's face again or something, but like, I mean, they're feeling good about themselves. And so a home game with the stakes being what they are and feeling good about the win that they got the other night, all caveats there mm-hmm. about KD. Yeah, I think they can win this tomorrow night. And if they do, our Father's Days will be slightly ruined, but we'll get an incredible game 7 to end what's been an amazing series. And I think, you know, I still think the Raptors will be favored.
Listeners, you know I like anything that can save me time, and SeatGeek has emerged as the go-to time saver for buying tickets to anything, NBA playoffs, any other sporting event, concerts, comedy shows, Broadway shows, more. SeatGeek has all the tickets you're looking for. It searches the entire secondary market almost and puts it all in one place that's super easy to use. It rates every deal on a scale of 1 to 10. It has green dots for good deals, red dots for less good deals. It has an interactive seating map so you know exactly where your seat is, whether anything's in the way, all of that stuff. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. It is by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. They help me get tickets to Hamilton, which is a tough ticket to get. SeatGeek will, for now, even give you $10 off your first purchase. All you need to do is use the promo code I'm about to tell you about. You got to download the SeatGeek app, use promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code LOW for $10 off your first purchase on SeatGeek.
The level of shot making by the Splash Brothers in that game was absolutely outrageous. And it's going to need to be that way again, I think, twice more for them to win.
Right. This is the margin of error thing, right? Like, they have no margin of error. And in fact, it's negative margin of error because they almost need those guys making 60% of their shots.
I mean, Klay is 20 of 35 from 3 in the series. And this is just what Klay does in the playoffs. Like, the guy just makes big shots. He rises up in the moment. The 3 threes that they made in the last 3 minutes were just incredible shots. The last one wasn't so much an incredible shot as an incredible sequence of passes to unlock that shot for Klay. But those guys are just balls to the wall, incredible. Put them in the Hall of Fame, obviously. Shoot, I mean, they're just incredible. They make huge shots. You can never, ever count them out. They have found ways to get free in this series, free enough by their standards. I mean, some of these are against great defense, you know, chasing them around and, you know, they figure out that whoever Gasol or Ibaka is guarding, let's run off a screen from that guy because the Toronto big guys don't want to come out and lunge at us. And I think they might have to start coming out and lunging at them or else they're going to get decent looks at threes. And, it's just an incredible shooting display, by those guys. But the other shot that's being the one I'll remember you know, the Lowry miss, the Lowry for the championship shot. With 2 minutes and 15 seconds left, the Raptors up three after the first Clay shot. Ran one of those sets on the right side where Lowry and Kawhi kind of screen for each other, which are great sets. They always produce good stuff. Kawhi back cut it. Both defenders went with Kawhi. Lowry got the best look at a three he will get in the entire series, and it's no one was in 15 feet of him, and he missed it. And that one's going to be lost to history, but I would be like Kyle Korver is still thinking about the left corner three in Cleveland from a couple seasons ago. That one's the one I'll be thinking about. I bet Kyle's thinking about that.
Yeah, and you wonder how much that lingers too. I mean, I think, you know, we'd agree this is a really this is a team with a steely resolve, and the Raptors don't seem they're we've talked about this. Kawhi is the embodiment of that team's personality. No, you know, not getting too high, not to getting too low, but to have the championship in your grasp at home, to have it that close and lose, it's got to be at least a little bit of a lingering effect of that as you're going back to Oracle, where it's going to be loud as hell and fans are going to be really into it. I mean, you know, I'm not saying it's going to make them wobbly. I think the Raptors, it's a veteran team. They're not going to be knocked off their game, but there's got to be that little seed of doubt that now is there.
You know, I'm interested in a lot of things about how the Raptors defend the Splash Brothers. I don't know that they have to really change anything, because I thought they did pretty well, but pretty well against those guys, like on a wrong night, is not going to be good enough. But I looked up the numbers today. The Steph Draymond pick and roll in this series, 1.35 points per possession anytime they run it. And I don't know really. Steph isn't like raining threes on those plays. He's gotten a couple good looks at step backs and stuff, or like Siakam, I think, has given him a little too much space. But what's happening a lot is the Raptors are kind of getting caught in between, where they'll bring Draymond's guy will come up to the level of the screen and kind of take Steph, and then kind of get caught in a switch, and Steph will just blow by him. And from there, it's layup or kick to Iguodala, who hit a couple of, a big corner three. Draymond hit a couple. They're just kind of getting caught in no man's land, and Steph is finding ways around them. He's getting to the free throw line. I'm interested to see if they trap those more aggressively. I'm not sure that's going to be, maybe they'll do that, or switch them more kind of cleanly. But Steph and Clay were just awesome, and that pick and roll has been giving everyone trouble for 5 years, so maybe there's not any answer to it. But yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see how the Raptors come out. Who guards Kawhi? I thought Andre had a kind of a throwback defensive game in a lot of game five. Like, the battle with Kawhi was almost an equal battle for the first time in that series. I don't know. What else are you looking for in this game? Talking about the game, it's refreshing.
Who are they starting? I mean, Cousins actually, I thought
Cousins.
I'm glad
you brought that up.
There's a point where I was like, I don't want to see Cousins ever play again. He was so bad in game four. I thought they just can't even afford to have him out there at all. And by all accounts, he wasn't going to play in game five until Durant went down. And he played pretty well. Does that give them enough confidence to roll him back out there to start the game? Do they want to start small? And if so, does that mean Livingston starts again? He's not been great in the series. Is Looney, you know, how many more blows to the chest can Looney take? You know, it's back to that numbers game.
Interestingly, their best lineup left would appear to be Steph, Andre, Clay, Draymond. So let's just call those the four core guys they have left.
Yes.
Plus Looney. Like, Looney's been their more reliable center. That lineup is minus 10 in the series in 41 minutes and has been not good defensively. And there is no bad luck from 3-point range happening there. The Cousins lineup is plus 6. But if you look at the numbers, it's 93 points per possession, 83 points allowed per possession. So there's some crazy good defense and or, good luck.
I would have not expected that part of it.
No, I wouldn't have either, particularly given the way, you know, whenever they went at Cousins on every single possession in the second half of game five.
We're also talking about a small enough sample size within a series that who knows.
Four baskets changes all that.
Yeah.
But I've been saying that I would just start Looney. I've been saying that for 2 weeks. Steve clearly doesn't want to do it. He started the second half.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're going to need to scrounge 14 points from the two centers somehow.
They had such a strong start. Now, granted, I mean, this is going to sound ludicrous as I say it. They had such a strong start the other night with a small lineup. yes, with KD, not Sean Livingston, but I wonder if just the idea that, you know what, starting small can produce some nice quick punch, and get the offense rolling. Maybe you do that just because you know, again, Sean Livingston is not Kevin Durant, but maybe just the stylistically and strategically what it does for you, maybe that's the way to go to start. I don't know.
They just haven't shown any willingness to go to that lineup without KD. There is a lineup, Steph, Livingston, Iguodala, Clay, Draymond, that is available to them. It has barely played at all. They've played with Jarebko more than they've played that lineup.
Another person who should not play again this
season. Well, you're going to say that and he's going to hit two threes. Like, they're just going to need to find 5 3-point shots from these guys who don't hit threes. They're going to need it because they can't get, you know, they can't count on 20 from the splash.
Maybe we get the Quinn Cook game.
Quinn Cook was so excited today that I put his fake timeout in my 8 frozen moments from game 5. Now, I don't think a lot of people, he did the fake timeout.
I had no idea until I think you tweeted about it, and then I went and I'm what? And I watched it. It's pretty subtle.
He did the motions that you're supposed to do. Like he slowed down and appeared to start to pick up his dribble and turned his back to the basket to face Steve Kerr. He was like, oh, show me where it is. So I showed him and he was like, play the clip. I wanted to see how convincing I was.
That's awesome.
He was like, you know, I've always wanted to kind of try it, but like Steph does it a lot, but like Steph is Steph. Like Steph can kind of do whatever he wants. Like I'm just Quinn Cook. I don't know if I'm allowed to defy Steve Kerr calling for a timeout. I have said this before. If I were a coach, it would be in my playbook. We would have that play. You can only use it like 5 times a year.
Yeah.
You got to surprise. I would have all sorts of crazy stuff. Did you ever see the barking dog play from like a high school game like 20 years ago?
No.
YouTube, when we're done, YouTube the barking dog play.
All right.
It was a baseline out of bounds play, I think. It might have been even a middle school game where the play was one of the players on the offensive team just gets down on his knees and starts barking like a dog. The entire defense looks at him like, what the hell is this guy doing? And you inbound the ball and score. Tell me that would not work in the NBA Finals. Tell me right now if Andre Iguodala or Jonas, you bring in Jarebko and he starts barking like a dog, you're not getting the layup out of that.
I love it. That would be up there with like Rick Barry's granny shots. Like, sure, it's really effective, but nobody wants to actually do it because it feels less than manly. So yeah, you know what though? Nick Young would bark. If they still had Nick Young, he'd go out and bark. There's the list we should compile. NBA players who would be willing to do the barking part of the barking dog play. Oh, that also sounds like a really good IPA, by the way.
Yeah.
I have a barking dog, 12 ounce.
The Cousins thing is interesting. Because how much help you send at Kawhi pick and rolls and all this depends on like how confident are you in the two guys defending the pick and roll. And with Looney, they started to switch a little bit and just live with it. And Looney's good enough that you can hang. DeMarcus is not.
No.
And so if he's not capable of keeping the ball in front of him, you have to send more help and that affects everything else that happens around you, and I'm interested to see that. I'm interested to see if the Raptors switch a little bit more. They're missing opportunity. They don't want to switch that much on Steph because I think they just want to pursue Steph all over the floor and keep it simple. But there are times here or there in every game where they could, and it's easy, and there's a defender right there, and they're not doing it, and both of the Splash Brothers are getting threes out of it. The other thing with Cousins, they did one time, they did what I call the Brook Lopez switch, which is like when they could see the Raptors calling up Cousins guy for a pick and roll, Draymond Green will run and replace Cousins and they'll shove Cousins somewhere else. And then you got to call up another guy and you keep doing that until DeMarcus can't get out of the play. But they did that a few times. That was interesting. There has been a lot of interesting basketball in this series. It's just been overshadowed by everything else.
It's been nuts. I mean, I've said it many times. You said it earlier. There's never been a finals like this. This is my 18th or 19th finals. I've never seen anything like it. Going all the way back to the beginning of it, frankly, with just the fact that Durant wasn't playing but was potentially coming back at any given time to change the entire complexion of the series. That alone lent a different air to this one than anything else, plus all the other stuff you've already listed.
It's going to be an interesting... I assume the Warriors have something special planned for the last game at Oracle. It's kind of weird because you can't plan it for Game 4, because then you're kind of acknowledging, like,
we're not going to be
might
back.
Lose and then lose again.
No, now that there's certainty, I do wonder. I already tweeted this joke, but Sarah McLachlan is singing O Canada.
Yeah.
So I want her to close the building by singing I Will Remember You as I walk out for the last time.
In slow motion? Will you walk in slow motion?
I'll walk in slow motion. There'll be a montage of my great writing moments.
So you'll just be on a laptop?
Right. Exactly. Me interviewing, Andres Biedrich, 10 years ago or something.
About his lack of free throw shooting ability.
Exactly.
Like 16% from the line 1 year or something like that.
Yeah. I want a Sarah McLachlan montage. That's all I want.
The last O Canada, I think, was when they had that 4-person guitar thing.
What the hell was that?
Before.
That was the strangest thing.
I love how the national anthem before every game becomes like the most, everyone is very into critiquing and analyzing each national anthem. Like, we should have a guitar national anthem every time. That's the best kind of, what is this 4-person guitar? Oh, that was the longest. This woman is taking too long to sing the national anthem. Everyone has incredibly strong feelings about the national anthem.
I normally do not.
Both national anthems.
But the 4-person guitar thing was the single strangest thing I've ever seen in my life.
You can't get past how strange it is.
No.
They could be making the most beautiful, they look like four people sharing a Halloween costume or something. Like, they just, it didn't look.
It was, yeah, you're right. I don't remember how they sang. I don't remember if it was good or not good. All I could do was just stare and say, I don't know what I'm watching right now. So.
I'll tell you what is good. When they just let the fans sing O Canada.
That is awesome.
That's good.
And they do it very well. Yeah. I got some anthem takes, but we'll save that for another day.
Trying to think if I have any other final stuff. The Toronto centers were really, I thought, good in game 5. Surge had a couple good games in a row that were good. The numbers with Kawhi at power forward, that was interesting how they closed the game without Siakam for the last 9 minutes, are very good. But, Pascal is an important part of their team. Obviously, he's going to play a lot and has been good in this series for the most part. So, I don't know. It feels like Toronto should win tomorrow. I am picking Toronto to win tomorrow. Don't feel good about it. I think the Warriors are favored. But I do – the sense I've gotten all year from the Raptors is they are generally a kind of an unfazed team. I think they're not a team that's going to be rattled by having gotten so close that you could sniff it. Partly because I think they don't actually think they were that close. They have enough respect for the Warriors. They know 3 minutes for those guys is an eternity. But I think they wash their hands of it. They move on. They're confident. I think that they feel they should win.
They should.
And that's the appropriate attitude, obviously. Yeah. I guess we have to talk about Anthony Davis.
We should. You had a nice story about the situation today.
So. Well, I was one of 17 people that participated in that story, but mostly Woj.
One out of 17, so 1/10 of the ESPN staff then. That's here.
Yeah, we have a lot of people here. we really do. It appears like this is, we all just lived through this 4 months ago, where we're like, oh, it's the Lakers. Oh, it's like deja vu. Like, here we go and blah, blah, blah. It appears, not it appears, there are somewhat accelerating trade discussions to get Anthony Davis out of New Orleans. The reporting from Woj is that the Lakers are maybe haggling over Kuzma, but maybe not being put in the deal. That the Lakers and or Pelicans are trying to see what the number 4 pick that belongs to the Lakers could fetch in terms of a player in the NBA currently that the Pelicans may want more than the number 4 pick. Obviously, an alternative to that would be New Orleans keeping the number 4 pick and asking the Lakers to trade one of their other players that they don't want for an asset that the Pelicans would want. So that's why you're seeing a lot of Lonzo Ball to X for draft pick X going to New Orleans. It feels like it's going to happen. Brooklyn, the Clippers, the Knicks will sniff around too, but everything I have heard, and this is really interesting, is that Boston is not afraid. Boston is not afraid of Rich Paul coming out again in Sports Illustrated saying they can trade for him. It's just going to be for a year. Not afraid. And I don't see a way that Boston can get him without trading Tatum. And so Now, whether you have to include Tatum and the Memphis pick, which is their only golden chip left. And by the way, the last golden chip they had was the Kings pick. It didn't turn out to be all that golden because the Kings got pretty good. So you never know. That would hurt me a little bit to give Tatum and the Memphis pick if I were Danny Ainge. But you then have a team. If Kyrie still walks, you're asking yourself, okay, Marcus Smart, Jaylen Brown, Gordon Hayward, Anthony Davis, Al Horford, assuming he opts out and resigns, Terry Rozier maybe off the bench, maybe Marcus Morris off the bench, maybe a mid-level exception guy. How good is that team? If Kyrie walks, how good is that team? That's the question you have to ask. Now, you could maybe have intel that getting Anthony Davis now changes Kyrie's whole decision. By the way, Kyrie's whole decision just got changed, whether you like it or not, by what we saw in Toronto when Kevin Durant crumpled to the ground.
Yes.
That has to help Boston a little bit, as unsavory as that is to say. But unless you know that, you have to be prepared for a world where he walks, because Brooklyn just traded 2 first-round picks to open up more money. And that's your team, the team that I just outlined. Is that team good enough to get Anthony Davis to stay? Because if it's not, and he walks, I don't care. You can talk me into, well, we still have a lot of draft assets. We still have Jaylen. By the way, don't have that many draft assets, but we love Marcus. We love Jaylen. We can start over with all the young guys we have left over. That is a killer. To lose Tatum, Kyrie, and Davis is a killer. Now, their asset base is still stable enough that they're not going to go all the way to the bottom, which maybe isn't even a good thing. But that's the question you have to ask yourself. That team I outlined, is it good enough?
I don't know, because here's what we still don't know. And here's what Danny Ainge can't know, as much as he is, you know, a bold gambling type and is always going to bet on figuring it out. And is Kawhi still in the East? There's question number one. Is Kawhi still with the Raptors? Because if not, then the Raptors sink. How do the Bucks do in re-signing all of their key free agents?
Let's assume the Bucks retain everybody they want.
Yeah. And I think chances are the Bucks are going to retain at least two of them. They'll keep Middleton, maybe Lopez. Well, Lopez is the hard one.
Lopez
because
is
they
hard.
Don't
if
bird
Lopez
rice.
Gets too hard, you can keep Brogdon.
Right.
Mirotić gone.
I think, complete hunch. I think Brogdon's gone. I think Brogdon's going to get some awesome offer somewhere. I think he's really, really good, and there's a bunch of teams that need a point guard, and he's just. I'm not going to say he's everything you want. He's not an all-star, but he's steady. He's smart. He's a defender. He shoots threes. He's just like Malcolm Brogdon's a guy I would want on my team, and there are teams out there that could really use a stabilizing guy like him.
There were times in that Toronto series as the wheels were falling off that he felt like the second most important player on their team.
Yeah. I think that makes that all the more reason why it's going to be hard to keep him. Anyway, so let's assume the Bucks are largely still the Bucks, and they did have the best record in the East. Sixers are such a volatile beast. I think Butler probably stays, but we don't know.
I've already predicted on TV, and the Sixers fans got mad at me, that not everybody is coming back. So let me be more specific. If I had to make a Sixers prediction on who isn't coming back, now I'm not including Jonathan Simmons and all the bit players and this and that. I'm talking about the main guys. My prediction right now would be Jimmy Butler stays and Tobias Harris leaves.
Agreed.
I don't feel... And again, whenever you say these things, people, well, you have 100% certainty. I don't have 100% certainty. How could I? I don't know what level of certainty I have. I don't have any, what level of probability I would assign to it. But if you're forcing me to make a prediction, I think for various reasons that Tobias Harris is on another team next year.
I agree. And it's a feel thing. It's a kind of just like what feels right, what feels logical, what feels, plausible and given the costs and everything else involved. So, does a Sixer team with Simmons, Embiid, Butler...
Let's assume JJ comes back.
How good is that team versus the Celtics team with Anthony Davis, Gordon Hayward, a re-signed Al Horford...
Jaylen Brown,
Marcus... That's still a pretty good team. And if... Listen, let's remember a couple things. One, Celtics did get to the conference finals Game 7 without Kyrie and Gordon Hayward, right? That's like part of the lore now. They got to Game 7 against LeBron. It doesn't mean that you could do that again just by eliminating those guys. But we know there's a version of that Celtics team that's really, really good. And Jaylen Brown, we presume, is going to take another step forward. And we also presume that Kyrie Irving, if not the entire reason, certainly not the entire reason, but a large part of the reason that their chemistry was screwy and everything else. Also, by the way, just thinning the herd. Trading for Anthony Davis, by definition, is going to thin the herd. So part of what the problem was probably too many guys who needed too many shots and too many minutes, and Brad Stevens couldn't quite figure out how to keep everybody happy. As a result, nobody was happy. So a different version of that team with fewer stars to placate or fewer young up-and-coming guys to placate might be a stronger, more cohesive unit. The talent will still be there, and Anthony Davis takes them to another level. Is that team good enough to compete with the Bucks and the weird Sixers and whatever is the Raptors? I think they're in the mix again. And by the way, the Raptors had phenomenal chemistry. They have some age issues. We don't know who of that team is coming back, even if Kawhi does. And you also, you know, year to year, the chemistry changes sometimes. We don't know if that same magic will last into another season. If I'm Danny Ainge, I'd feel pretty damn confident in the group that you just laid out. I also believe this. I said this to you earlier. The finals, this is this testament to why you take a swing. If there's a chance to get a top 10 guy on a 1-year deal, you do it because Paul George might just re-sign with you. Kawhi Leonard might just lead you to the finals.
My first glance at that Boston team, the imaginary no Kyrie, yes AD team, and no Tatum, is it doesn't have enough perimeter shot creation because I can't assume that Gordon Hayward is Gordon Hayward again. After watching him last year, now I assume he's going to be better in year two.
Paul George took a while.
Became Paul George again. But I'm just like, I'm not going to just blanket assume pencil in 25 and 5
fair
on good shooting next season. Maybe I hope he gets there. Certainly had games where he looked like he was getting there and then had entire weeks where he disappeared. However, they would, you know, Baines just opted in. He's an important part of their team. They would be fairly deep. And that, if your starting lineup is Smart, Hayward, Brown, Davis, Horford, you have a chance to be the best defensive team in the league. In the regular season, that's going to win you a lot of games. In the playoffs, offense, unless somebody pops or Gordon Hayward pops back to being Gordon Hayward, offense might be something of an issue, like dumping it down to, like, having your two big guys be so responsible for shot creation is a little dicey, but I may be underestimating that team because of how good it could be defensively. That could be the best defensive team in the league.
And we should factor in too, like, how much more Al Horford is there, you know, to speaking of age issues. But no, on its face, I think that could be a good enough team to be contending and to be in that top four again with a chance to go very deep. And look, one of the things that you're doing when you're making a gamble on Paul George or on Kawhi Leonard, or in this case on Anthony Davis, is on, you know, all those other intangibles we talk about, the culture of your team, the strength of your coaching staff and your training staff. And I go back to the quote that somebody gave me back in December, whenever it was, that I finally used in my Kawhi Leonard story a few weeks ago, which was that Kawhi Leonard, another GM had said, Kawhi Leonard is going to end up staying because Alex McKechnie is going to make him feel better than he's ever felt. And we'll see. You know, load management has produced great results for them and has probably made Kawhi feel that much better about his time with them.
I'm glad you brought up Alex McKechnie because I want to go back to the KD thing. Mark Cuban had this thread yesterday on Twitter about how we need more study of ligaments and tendons and things that connect other things, and particular study of who is susceptible to what and when and how, preemptive. And you will hear the sports scientist guys say this, what Mark said in that tweet, that it's as much art as it is science. And that's their way of saying, like, you're not going to get 100% certainty from the science. You're going to have a feel for each guy and each body part and each guy's injury history and all of this. And a lot of it is going to be your experience and your feel for the situation. And like, so maybe like, if maybe this is a learning point for the entire sports science community, where like there was a pretty high level of analysis that determined this calf issue or whatever it was, or a calf strain, was not connected enough to whatever to be an Achilles risk. Well, that turned out to be wrong. Or it certainly looks like it turned out to be wrong. And maybe that's a window into just like how hard all of this stuff is, how much art
it really is, because there was a whole medical determination made that what happened couldn't happen by some of the leading people in the business. Anyway, so about Kawhi. So I do agree, one of the lessons of the Kawhi thing, and I have a piece that's going to come up about this, so I don't want to get too far into it, is like, so about a year ago, I wrote a column about the difficulty the Celtics faced in deciding whether to include Jaylen Brown in a Kawhi Leonard offer. A year later, that column looks silly, right? Because look at what Kawhi Leonard is doing, and look at what Jaylen Brown did in a semi-disappointing year, and look how, now, I address all this in the column, but like, the Celtics and the Lakers and the Sixers and the other teams that did not trade for Kawhi Leonard, fearing that he would walk away, had much more downside in trading for him than the Raptors did. The Raptors had none, essentially none. So the equation is not the same. The Celtics thought incorrectly they already had a championship caliber team, right? And they thought, we have a championship caliber team right now without Kawhi Leonard, and Jaylen Brown is a big part of a championship team that we think we have 10 years from now.
Yes.
And so we're so worried that A, Kawhi will leave, and B, we're not 100% sure Kawhi is ever going to be the same player again. And people have forgotten how everyone in the league, including the Raptors, was like, is he 80%, 90%? If he's 90% of what he used to be, how good is that player? Is it worth giving up the farm?
There was a cloud over.
There was a huge cloud, even for the Raptors. But I do think the lesson that I have learned, and why I'm willing to say that column, I think, was overcautious for sure, was number one, if it's a top five player, and even if you already have what you think is a championship team, go get that guy, because that guy is going to boost your championship odds so significantly that it matters. And number two, the status quo changes. You just have to remind yourself, the status quo changes so fast. So a year ago, the Celtics didn't trade for Kawhi Leonard. They came to the same conclusion. They did not put Jaylen Brown in the offer. They were incredibly confident in their core. I was incredibly confident in their core. Brian Windhorst was calling Jason Tatum the best player on the team, and he was agog, to use a word that Brian Windhorst likes to use, of how good Jason Tatum was. I said they were set up to contend for 10 years. Kyrie Irving said, if you'll have me, I'll resign. Everything went to hell, and now everything is on the table for them again. And so the lesson of that is, like, no matter how it looks today, it's not going to be like that. It's not always going to be like that in 2 years and 3 years and 4 years. And if you have a chance to get some certainty at a price that is reasonable to you, even if it's a higher price than you want to pay, you should be more aggressive. You should be more aggressive than I was. You should be more aggressive than the Celtics were. And in retrospect, putting Jaylen Brown in is something they should have done. Even saying that, the entire discussion changes if Kawhi Leonard leaves Toronto on July 1st. The entire discussion changes if that shot bounces four times and out and they lose in the second round.
Yes.
That's how thin the margins are. And by the way, back to Boston, it's fashionable to say the reason they believe they were a championship contender is they took Cleveland to 7 in the conference finals that year. You know what else happened to them? They barely beat the Bucks in 7 in the first round of that same playoffs. Yeah. That's how slim the margins are.
Can I say it?
Yes.
These things turn on a trifle.
Oh, you like that one.
It's my Phil Jacksonism. These things turn on track. Listen.
My Phil Jacksonism is, how's it going?
We often forget the details that you just listed. It's like, you know, I'm fond of talking about how the Lakers were this close to not winning two of their three championships in the Shaq Kobe run. It's often that close. And yes, Kawhi Leonard, I mean, this is the ultimate example. Because we're not going to forget about the four bounces, because it was so incredible and memorable and etched in our brains. We won't forget that one, but we should bring it up in the context of discussions like this, because they were just that close. And granted, it's overtime. They might have still won, but they were potentially just that close to not getting out of the second round. And yes, then our discussions are entirely different about the gamble that they made on Kawhi, because then it's, well, they lost in the second round, and Kawhi is certainly, it's understandable if he wants to go chase his dreams now back in LA or wherever. Early this season, I know for a fact that Boston, one of the reasons they were confident in an AD eventual trade was the idea that AD and Kyrie were texting buddies and wanted to play with each other. And then eventually that faded away and it became Kyrie and KD are buddies and they want to play together. But before that, it was AD and Kyrie. And so I've often thought there's a chicken and egg thing here. Does getting AD in a draft night trade that you can't execute, but you agree to, just like they did with Pierce and Garnett years ago, does that convince Kyrie to stay? And when you say, well, why would you even want Kyrie to stay? Well, one, because you don't want to just lose an all-NBA second-team guard for nothing, even if you decide to part with him later. But two, any chemistry issues you had are involving some of your younger players who may be going out the door to get AD anyway, and that might solve your chemistry
issues.
This is
why the Nets are interesting, because I don't think any team in the league conceives as Kyrie Irving as the best player on a great championship team.
No.
So when you see a team clear two max slots,
yes,
and one of them's for Kyrie, they got someone else in mind for the other one who's better than Kyrie.
Yes.
So that's why, like, the Nets is very interesting to me, because the Nets have been all about their culture and the careful cultivation of this culture, and everything is copacetic and everyone gets along and there's no chemistry issues and everyone's rowing in the same direction and all of this. It struck me as very interesting that that team would move heaven and earth to put Kyrie Irving, who is not a bad guy. I'm not saying Kyrie Irving's a bad guy. I'm just saying we just saw a whole year of chemistry problems that stemmed in part from his presence on the team, the weird stuff he said to the media, the weird stuff he said behind closed doors. And you're moving heaven and earth to bring that guy into the environment that has been so pristine. It's like a little cocoon you've protected. You know why? Because someone else is going to come with him.
Absolutely, positively, I have said the same. The first reaction when you hear that they're making room, or that they are making all these maneuvers, or even before they were making those moves and they were just simply tied strongly to Kyrie, you have to wonder, because this is a team that has rebuilt itself over the last few years under Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson as being a team that's all about culture, all about the right things, all about building a team that overachieved because they had a bunch of high character guys playing for each other. And D'Angelo Russell was the wild card in there, and they even got the best version so far that we've seen of D'Angelo Russell, even while feeling that maybe like the clock is ticking and you never know what
even
may be coming next.
Even while feeling like, what's he carrying in through security at LaGuardia? Why? Nothing
that I haven't smelled 1,700 times in the last 2 weeks in Toronto and San Francisco.
Yeah, but you ain't carrying it through security at Pearson Airport.
No. So I look at that, and I think if the team that has built itself this way, that is so all about the right things, is willing to bring in Kyrie, and I'm not saying he's about the wrong things, I'm just saying he's a volatile piece. Then
volatile is a good word.
You're doing it for other reasons. And yes, when you create the second max slot by offloading Allen Crabbe with some picks, when you've always been in asset acquisition mode, and now you all of a sudden you're flipping some of those assets. And granted, look, they got a decent young player in Torian Prince back as well. So it's not like
that matters.
That matters.
It's part of the calculus.
It's not just a straight.
They're going to let him chuck threes and he's going to make a lot of threes.
It's not just a straight salary dump. You're setting yourself up for something. And my suspicion was, forget the second max slot. Maybe this is also back to the AD Kyrie text buddies thing. Maybe they're the ones who are trying to line that up. That if AD and Kyrie truly want to play together, hey, look, Kyrie, we've got the room for you. And by the way, now we're going to make this deal to trade Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie, Jared Allen, and some other combination of picks that they still have, and maybe even rerouting Prince or something, to get Anthony Davis. I don't know. That one's just straight out of my brain and not based on anybody whispering anything. It's just it feels like that makes sense. And certainly the move for Kyrie has to have another component behind it. Just upgrading from D'Angelo Russell to Kyrie. And by the way, I don't buy any of this idea that, oh, Kyrie and D'Angelo are going to play together. No, they're not. If you're signing Kyrie, you're not keeping D'Angelo Russell.
So Woj just tweeted, as we're saying this, within weeks of free agency, Boston Celtics star Kyrie Irving and his longtime agent Jeff Wexler have parted ways. Boston's Kyrie Irving is expected to partner with Roc Nation Sports for representation, league sources tell ESPN, which is only going to fuel the net speculation even further, given Jay-Z's connections to Roc Sports and all of this. Not that Jay-Z is that connected anymore.
With the Nets, no.
This has been long rumored. Wexler has lost clients before. Remember, he famously is the one that lost Harrison Barnes because he wouldn't budge, justifiably, I think, from the 4% commission fee. I believe Wexler also represents Jason Tatum, who is close friends with Kyrie Irving, which is also interesting. Sometimes those agency changes mean something in terms of what team the guy wants to play for, and sometimes they don't. That will be interesting. Last thing, it will be fascinating to me to see what, if anything, the Lakers could turn the number 4 pick into for the Pelicans. In terms of searching around the league for like young-ish good players, it's really hard to find one that would be available for the number 4 pick. Like Bradley Beal's too good for the number 4 pick. Bradley Beal would demand 4 plus, the Wizards demand 4 plus something else.
No doubt.
Although I think that's the right kind of, it's the right idea. I saw Kevin O'Connor mention Aaron Gordon. That's interesting. The first name I thought of was Zach LaVine.
Hmm.
Cause I think the Bulls might do that. LaVine for number 4. There, you can also go the other way and look at sort of distressed recent lottery picks. Like, but you'd have to really like those picks. So if you were a big fan of Josh Jackson, could you go to Phoenix and say, we'll give you 4 for Josh Jackson plus something else? Josh Jackson's been a disappointment. Number 4, if you're a big Mo Bamba believer, could you go to Orlando and say, we'll give you 4 for Mo Bamba plus a future first, plus whatever the plus is that makes up for the fact that Mo had a disappointing rookie season, blah, blah, blah. It's just going to be very interesting to see what, if anything, that turns into. But it was hard for me to find a good player in their age range on a team that would be willing to take what amounts to a step back. Like, you could argue, like, what about, you know, if Portland decides we're hovering too much, even though we just made the conference finals, in theory, CJ McCollum for the number 4 pick, but they're not going to do that. That's not a realistic value for them. It's not even close.
Here's the problem with the, what can the Lakers get for the 4th pick? Cause it sounds good, but from what, and you and I think we feel the same about this. We're not draft experts, and you know, we're just learning all these guys as we go, as we approach the draft, because we're just too immersed in the NBA. I have been told by the draft experts that the range after those top 3 guys, 4 through 11, 4 through 12, 4 through something, is about the same. And if that's the case in terms of upside and blemishes and concerns and talent level and whatever, they're all just different versions of the same bag of pros and cons. I don't know how valuable the 4th really is versus the 7th or the 11th or the 12th pick. And it costs you more because of the way the rookie scale is designed. So the benefit of having the 4th pick is that if you as a team, you're the Pelicans and you're acquiring the 4th pick, or you're that third team that's acquiring it, if you believe that one player out of that 4th through 12th range in the mock drafts is clearly the one that you think has the best upside, or that you're sure everybody else is missing on, or, you know, you give yourself certainty. You get the 4th pick, you give yourself certainty about the guy you can get in that 4th through 12th range if you think one guy really does stand out. But if the draft experts that I've talked to are correct, and that is all very murky in that range, then it's not really worth that much, and it costs you more.
So maybe what you're saying is it all comes back to number 3 and the fighting New York Knickerbockers and their stockpile of young players that nobody wants except for Mitchell Robinson. I saw Ian Begley report today that the Knicks are going to be hesitant to part with young players and good draft picks for Anthony Davis. So what are they trading? Share stock in MSG? Like, what's the trade? I don't understand. If there's one team that hit the floor when Kevin Durant hit the floor, it's the Knicks.
Isola had a great line in his column on The Athletic about that you have expected Bob Myers, when he got off the dais, to like hand the microphone to Steve Mills, who would then express all of his remorse and regret.
I didn't see that.
He wrote it differently than that, but that was the basic idea. I laughed. The Knicks put a lot of eggs in that basket. And they'll deny it when the summer's over and they've got whoever they've got. And maybe it's KD.
Maybe it's KD. I don't think it's going to affect. I bet they still make them a big offer. I bet they still offer them what they would offer them before.
Yeah.
The one team that may not, and I don't think he was going to go there anyway, is the Lakers. I don't think he was going to touch the Lakers. I don't think that was a real thing. But that's the one team you can look at and say, we can't wait a year. Like, we don't have a year to wait.
Here's the thing, and I don't want to get too far down the Knicks rabbit hole, but If the Knicks sign KD to a 4-year max and say, you know what, it's fine, we're willing to wait, and we believe he'll be fine, even though the Achilles is one of the hardest, if not the hardest injury to come back from, you are basically writing off next season also, which is fine. Maybe that you're a tanking year and yeah, another high pick isn't the worst thing in the world. But if the idea was to get two guys, all right, well, now Kyrie has to decide, do I want to carry that team by myself while I'm waiting for him? And again, to the point of the young players, their young players are not very good. That's not
yet. Some of them are so young. Like, I'm not writing off Kevin Knox.
Your number one is discouraging,
but
I'm not writing off Kevin Knox, but your one was alarming. And some of the things I've heard about just his motor and everything else make me concerned that, that who he is at 19 might just be who he is, but we'll see. But if you're Kyrie Irving, are you willing to go Bernie? You're waiting for KD to get healthy, and now you're banking on, does he ever return to full KD form after the Achilles? Or is it somebody else? And is that person willing to carry the load and all the expectations that come with it after the Knicks, you know, got everybody's hopes up by all the moves they made? This is going to be a big, big summer. And then it's, we've got an injured KD that we're waiting on for a season, possibly a full season. It could be less, but it could be a full season missed. And he's going to come back at age 32 in 2020 with off an Achilles. I'm hoping for the best, as we all are. But we have to be realistic and note that the history of guys coming back from Achilles is checkered at best. So we don't know. And so that second player that the Knicks are trying to get is on his own for a while. I don't know. That I think that factors into this too. And, you know, the Knicks have to consider that. The other player, mystery max player X, has to consider that. I don't know. And I also, by the way, just think this too. Yes, of course, if you've got cap room, 4 years, 164 for KD, one of the greatest players of all time, I guess you have to do it, but it might not go right. It might not. And the Knicks have a long history of having made bad bets for a lot of money on players with injury concerns coming in. Amari Stoudemire, Allen Houston, Penny Hardaway, you know, they had McDyce's deal that they had to deal with. Now, McDyce, I don't think there were warning signs there. They just got him, and then his leg blew up. But they've got a long history of having big contracts on injured players that have hampered them. And does that at least give you some pause?
Well, let's pause here because we do have an NBA Finals to sort out. We will be at Oracle Arena for the very last time tomorrow. Howard Beck, the people always love when you come on. Thank you for your time, and we'll see what happens tomorrow, Game 6.
Thanks, Zach. Yeah, can't wait.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.